said. The other boys sniggered at that. "Are we to do this again?" The Sangheili shook his head on his long stock of a neck in a weary way. "Do what?" Seb said. "Put you in your place?"
"I am where I am meant to be, human."
Carl smirked at that and glanced about as if looking for something.
"Really?
This doesn't look like a hospital to me."
"Or a graveyard," Andre said darkly. His tone was more unsettling to Molly than Carl's or Zeb's.
The other boys were being cruel, but Andre sounded as if he didn't want bruises, but blood.
"We have been through this ritual several times," the Sangheili said. "What will it take to put an end to it?"
"That's simple." Carl leaned in toward the Sangheili. "All we have to do is put an end to you." That's when Gudam appeared between the two boys. "Hey, Carl, what's up?" she said in a dangerously happy voice. The boys had been too focused on each other to see the young boy slipping up until the last second. She was so small and slight in her movements that it was easy to lose track of her. Both the Sangheili and the human boys edged back, completely off guard. Carl didn't just move back, though. He must have seen the young boy as a threat, and he lashed out with a punch. His fist caught Gudam on the right side of the tube that covered her nose. With a horrible crack, it went flying off to one side, along with a spatter of glowing blue blood.
Molly was stunned.
She looked around the courtyard for someone, a teacher, anyone who could help.
There were only students, all of them staring at the scene, frozen.
Gudam spilled backward, her limbs splayed out in every direction. The pack on her back slewed off at an awkward angle and began leaking methane. She started coughing, clearly unable to properly breathe the oxygen all around her.
This had suddenly become very serious.
Karim ran to Gudam and knelt down next to her, checking to see if she was all right. Molly wanted to do the same, but for some reason didn't. She just stood there, feeling helpless.
"You attack a little Ungoy?"
The Sangheili stabbed a long finger at Carl.
"For the crime of greeting you? This time you have gone too far."
The Sangheili was angry. This much Molly could clearly see. As much as she didn't like him or his kind, she couldn't blame him. Molly may not have had a long list of friends inside Onyx, but Gudam was about the friendliest creature Molly had ever met. It didn't matter to her what grievance Carl might have against the diminutive creature. She didn't deserve to get laid out like that. No one did.
"You think so?" Carl said.
He had reeled back for an instant when he'd seen how badly he'd hurt Gudam. Now he stepped forward again, owning the attack and evidently hungry to mix it up with the Sangheili. Carl thought he had finally found something that pissed the alien off enough to drag him into a fight.
"Let's see just how far we can take this."
Carl reached out and pushed the Sangheili. To Molly's surprise, the alien didn't stop him. He didn't raise a hand at all. Molly scanned the courtyard again, hoping to find an adult this time. She saw other Sangheili fledglings. They were watching, too. For a second, she thought they would step in to defend one of their kind. Yet,
none of them even moved in the direction of the fight.
Instead, once they discerned what was happening, they all turned away, completely uninterested.
Molly didn't understand. Are they going to let one of their kind get pummeled?
"Some hinge head you are," Carl growled, pushing the Sangheili again.
"You're going to just let me shove you around like that? Don't you have the guts to do anything about it?"
The Sangheili flexed his big fists.
"I do not care to fight you, human."
"I didn't ask you that." Carl shoved him with both hands this time, much harder than before.
"Did I?"
Still, the Sangheili only staggered back, regained his footing, and did nothing. He just glared at Carl as if he might snap at any moment and bite the boy's head off. Carl sneered at the Sangheili.
"You don't care what we might do to you?"
Carl turned toward Gudam.
"Or your little pet here?"
That was it for Molly. She couldn't just stand there and watch anymore. Not with Gudam lying there, hurt and struggling to breathe.
"Someone has to stop this," she thought.
Then, without her recognizing it,
Her own anger suddenly took over and moved her feet for her. Her instincts had kicked in again. Molly barreled toward the conflict and came between the young goy and Carl. "Knock it off, all of you!" Molly hated bullies. She always had, especially the kind who picked on people smaller than them. It probably had something to do with her having had to fend for herself in the last two schools, or perhaps it was because of what had happened to her family on Paris 4. The bottom line was that she didn't let anyone push her around. Not ever. As Asha often told her, it's not the size of the dog in the fight that matters. It's the size of the fight in the dog. And Molly could fight big if someone pushed the right buttons. Carl stepped back and gawked at her audacity. "Are you kidding me? You're going to stand up for that thing?" He clearly hadn't processed the possibility of a human defending an alien. Molly didn't blame him for that. She hadn't foreseen it herself until just a second before doing it. "I don't care about him, or her, or whatever," she said as she got up in his face. "You don't get to step up to someone minding their own business and start knocking them around." Taken aback momentarily, Carl recovered and glared at Molly, raising his hand to her much as he'd done to Goddam. Molly hadn't surprised him, though. He wasn't about to smack her down out of some mistaken instinct of self-preservation, or out of some anger he'd held over from the war. He was just furious at her for having dared to try to stop his bullying. This time, he was going to hit a human being, and he was going to mean it. Molly cocked back her leg, preparing to kick him, but Carl knocked her flat before she could even strike. He had backhanded her across the jaw, and she felt a sting of pain as her lower lip split open against her teeth. Molly fell to the ground, clutching her mouth. Although she'd been through a war and had dealt with all sorts of bullies in other schools, she'd never been in a real fist fight before. It wasn't the pain that shocked Molly, at least not at first. It was the idea that someone would actually hit her. "Damn hingehead hugger," Carl spat at her. Molly pulled her hand away, and it was covered with blood. Kareem launched himself at Carl. He came at him from the side but didn't get far. Zeb and Andre grabbed Kareem before he laid a hand on their friend. Together they slammed Kareem to the ground, flat on his back. Molly heard the air escape his lungs as the wind was knocked out of him. Kareem was struggling to breathe now, too. Molly quickly recovered. She jumped to her feet and lunged at the boys, who'd begun kicking at Kareem. Just before she reached them, Carl stuck out his leg and tripped her. Rather than tackling Andre, she stumbled into him. Andre shoved Molly back and took a step toward her, his fists up and ready. His knuckles darted out and slammed into her face before she could regain her balance. Molly stumbled backward, howling and holding her eye, trying to figure out what the hell had just happened and hoping he hadn't blinded her for life. Someone's hands caught Molly and kept her on her feet. She looked up to see Andre moving above her, his other fist cocked back to hammer at her again. Molly braced herself for the blow. This one was probably going to knock her out cold. These jerks would actually hit a girl. Then a voice from behind her boomed out. "Hold it!" Andre froze, his arms still back and ready, but his eyes flung wide. He took a huge step back and put his hands in the air to show he had stopped. Molly took a moment to blink the pain from her eye and watched her vision slowly clear. Satisfied that she hadn't gone blind, but still wincing from the pain, she looked up to see who'd saved her. It was a Sangheili instructor Molly had glimpsed earlier that day. The first male elite she had ever seen in person and without any armor, unlike in the war vids she'd watched. The label outside his classroom had said that his name was Dinok Akroli, and apparently he specialized in xenolinguistics. This meant that he taught Sangheili how to speak to the humans, and vice versa. Molly hadn't signed up for any of his classes. She had no interest in learning Sangheili, or being taught by a giant monster. He was tall, with deep indigo skin, and he very much fit the mold of the elite warrior. The Sangheili instructor approached with a powerful confidence and disciplined movements, towering over all of the children in the fight. Even the Sangheili youth, who turned out to have been the person who had caught Molly, was taken aback in Dinnock's shadow. Despite not being dressed for war, the appearance of the massive Sangheili instructor had proven enough to subdue the entire crowd. Molly found herself legitimately scared for her life. Then she realized the young Sangheili was still next to her. She jerked away, glaring at him through her swelling eye. She couldn't help but recoil sharply at the realization that he had touched her. She didn't need any help in this fight, certainly not from a Sangheili. Dinnock glowered down at each of the seven children in turn and shook his head in dismay. "You are all in a world of trouble." For Molly, this was now officially her worst first day of school ever. Chapter 10 Molly's new parents weren't impressed by her getting into a fight on her first day at Onyx's school. They grounded her for the week. Since she had no social life, the punishment didn't mean all that much to Molly. But she decided not to point that out. She didn't need to give them a reason to come up with something worse. In actuality, they weren't that upset by what had happened. Asha even congratulated Molly on standing up to a bully, while Young got her a stim adhesive to bring down the swelling on her eye and lip. She explained to him that she'd already used two in the school infirmary, but he insisted. Asha and Young cared less about Molly's getting in trouble at school than they did about her putting herself in danger, especially given the nature of the altercation and the clear tension between the species at Pax Institute. This was not the picture of tranquility Director Mendez had painted for them. But school scuffles probably didn't rank high on his list of security concerns. Molly's official punishment at the Pax Institute was a one-day suspension, which Kareem got too. Carl, Zeb, and Andre were each sent home for a week. The two aliens involved weren't punished at all. That rankled Molly a bit because they were both at the center of the conflict. But since neither of them had thrown a punch, she couldn't argue with it. The bullies all accused Molly of attacking them out of the blue, but the three weren't the most clever kids. They must have known the school's security cameras would vindicate her. However, the fact she had attacked Carl before he hit her had forced Kashaw to punish her as well. "You're getting off easy because you have only been at school a few hours, and this is, of course, all new for you," Kashaw told Molly in her office, a strange hybrid of human and Sangheili design that somehow felt both open and claustrophobic. "Because of this, however, your record is no longer clean, so do your best to stay out of trouble from here on out. Understood?" Molly didn't feel that she deserved any scolding at all. She'd been trying to stop three bullies from beating the life out of two aliens, at least one of whom she should have left out to dry. But in the end, Molly understood. The headmaster had to deter fighting somehow. It probably was just a rumor, but she heard Carl and Zeb's and Andre's parents took them out to dinner that night for standing up to aliens. She found it hard to believe. Who are these parents? How do people like that get picked to be part of this project? Aren't there intensive screenings to root those kinds of people out? Molly could rationalize her own fears. She had good reason to be nervous about the aliens, but she still wasn't about to start picking a fight with them. On top of that, she wasn't one of the adults hired to do research here. If this baffling rumor about the bully's parents was true, it told a far bleaker story about Paxopolis than the city's name implied. When Molly had a chance to unpack all that had happened that day with her new parents, she found herself somewhat embarrassed by the whole thing. She hadn't intended to wind up on the side of aliens, even ones as harmless as Gudam. She'd been doing everything she could to avoid them until just minutes before the fight. But what made her even more uncomfortable was that the Sangheili fledgling had helped her. Molly hadn't needed his help, and she certainly hadn't been looking for it. The last thing she wanted was for people to think she was incapable of fighting her own battles, and so had to enlist the help of a Sangheili instead. She could take care of herself, especially with a bunch of jerks like those three. If she could have done it over again, she would have just ignored the whole incident and walked away. So why'd you do it, then? Asha asked.
Asha had this annoying way of cutting through all the emotional clutter around any issue and getting right to the heart of it.
Are you saying I did the wrong thing? Molly asked, confused.
Asha had seemed pretty supportive up till that point.
Not at all.
I'm asking why you stepped in to protect that Ungoy.
I already told you about that.
Asha gave Molly a weird, soft smile. It told her that Asha knew the answer to her own question already. She was just waiting for Molly to catch up.
I didn't ask what you did. I asked why.
Just give it some thought.
You'll have plenty of time for that during your suspension, Young said. He seemed to think the idea of Molly being punished was hilarious. Young knew what Molly was capable of in academics, and how she'd spent the last few years as a hermit within her old school, never being involved in anything controversial. She'd finally done something of note in a social context, a fistfight, and he found it too comical to consider it anything more than an extended joke. Unfortunately for her, Molly was the butt of that joke.
I'm not going back to that school, she told them flat out. You can't make me.
You're just upset, Young said. Give it some time.
We're sorry if we pushed you too fast, Asha said. It's just that you have to take this first step at some point. You staying home isn't going to make this any better. And our work is ramping up.
How can that be? Molly asked. Everything the Forerunners made has been lying around for more than 100,000 years. What's the sudden rush now? Is it that Goliath thing that you were talking about with Director Mendez and the Spartans?
Young frowned and exchanged a serious look with Asha. Molly had made a momentary lapse in the heat of the moment. She'd completely forgotten that she had been eavesdropping on that part of the conversation and wasn't supposed to know what they'd been chatting about. Yet another knee-jerk reaction of hers had gotten her into trouble.
You shouldn't have been listening to that, Molly, Young said, his eyes intensely serious.
I'm sorry. You're right, I shouldn't have, Molly said plaintively. But Young didn't scold her.
After Asha nodded, Young spoke to Molly in a hushed tone with a stern look on his face.
Can you keep a secret?
What do you mean? Molly asked.
Look, you've been through a lot today. We know this move wasn't exactly what you wanted. I feel bad. Asha feels bad. This transition was tougher on you than either of us, and we're only days in. We want to level with you about why we're here.
At least, Asha said, to help you understand why this is so important. But you've got to keep this under your hat, Molly. If you don't, we can get in a lot of trouble.
Not the kind of trouble you want us in either, Young said with a cold stare. The kind that lasts forever.
Okay, okay, Molly said. What's the big deal?
Project Goliath was focused on a large Forerunner machine Asha and I explored extensively years ago, hidden below ground on a colony world. Apparently, it's not the only one. They've discovered more of them recently, these enormous and ancient machines. They're actually cropping up all over the galaxy, on inhabited worlds even.
And this time it's different, Asha added.
They're not all just lying unresponsive below the ground anymore, which is how we found that one in the past.
Something's happening to them. Something potentially bad.
The reason we're here is that Oni needs our help to figure out what that thing is. Molly understood the facts logically, but she didn't see how any of it was relevant.
What does this have to do with me coming to Onyx and going to a school where I get beat up for defending aliens who I don't even like? If I don't want to go to the school again and I can learn from the networked tutor system at home, what does that have to do with your work?
We need you in school, Molly, Young said, not beating around the bush. You need to be around others your age, and you need to learn in a context like Pax Institute. You're not leaving the school. If it gets too difficult, we'll talk to the headmaster.
We love you, Molly,
Asha said with a concerned but sincere look on her face.
We're here for you.
But we can't have you at home all day looking after yourself. We need to know that you're safe and someone's keeping an eye on you.
and we want to impress upon you the importance of this project. Our work here on Onyx, it's not a game. It's really that serious. These machines, if they awaken, it's a matter of life or death for the people on those worlds.
Fine, Molly said flatly, realizing that their tip of the hand was to show her she wouldn't get her way. Just leave me alone. She stormed upstairs and locked herself in her room. Perhaps she should have been happy that her slip of the tongue hadn't resulted in a more severe punishment. But she was done. Molly didn't want any excuses from them, or to have to relive the fight or her motivations or any of that. She just wanted the day to end.
For the next few days, Molly's new parents actually left her alone. Molly didn't know if they thought that a kind of benign neglect was the best way to deal with her at the moment, or if they were just too busy with their own work. Or maybe they realized how angry she was about having to go back to that school, that they didn't want to engage her on that topic again unless they had to. Sometimes Molly questioned their parental abilities, but taking her in had been a bit of a surprise for them. As she grew older, though, her questioning became more frequent. At the age of 16, it happened most of the time. But if what they were saying about these incidents on other worlds was actually true, that this was a life-or-death situation, that certainly put a different spin on things. As Molly came down from the frustrations she'd felt immediately after the fight at school, she recognized that her squabble with those kids was insignificant against the backdrop of what was taking place on Onyx. The things that Young and Asha were dealing with were far more critical, and it was irrational for Molly to think otherwise. She decided that she'd cut her new parents some slack next time they had a conversation, but she still wasn't sure when she'd be ready to go back to school. Without the new parents at home to make her return, she'd been able to get away with hunkering down at home, at least for now. Molly took advantage of her free time by soaking up as much as she could from the news feeds. What she saw confirmed her suspicions. Asha and Young hadn't been joking about things heating up around human-occupied space. A litany of crazy rumors were coursing through the feeds, mostly about entire colonies going dark and the military being deployed in response. Was another war brewing? Or was this connected to the machines Young and Asha had mentioned? Seeing glimmers of the things her new parents had mentioned being reported on Waypoint was both eerie and sobering. Whatever's going on is real and scary. Real scary, even. Molly suddenly realized that living inside a gigantic Forerunner shell, surrounded by military personnel, did make her feel a bit safer. It didn't surprise her when Asha and Young sent a comm message on Friday night saying they had to work through the weekend on site. Molly wondered what that meant. Where exactly is on site? Exactly how connected is what they're working on here in Onyx to all those events out there? Maybe they weren't as safe as they had told her they would be. Molly figured that at least they wouldn't bother her about school during the weekend. But Monday still rocketed toward her like a maglev train. They clearly didn't want her to miss another day, but she wasn't sure she was ready to go back. "We'll talk about this tonight," Asha told her when leaving the house on Sunday morning. From that, Molly knew that her self-enforced suspension from school was about to come to an end. So she began steeling herself for what lay ahead, seeing those same kids. The ones she'd fought against, the ones who'd just gawked as it all went down, and even the ones she'd fought alongside. She just wanted to forget it all happened and never talk to any of them again. That afternoon, an unexpected visitor stopped by. Molly went to answer the doorbell and found Spartan Lucy standing on her doorstep, dressed in her UNSC fatigues. "Permission to come inside?"
"Of course."
Molly stepped aside and let her in, genuinely surprised. She hadn't seen Lucy, or Tom, or Director Mendez since the day she and her family had arrived. It was a big shield world, after all. Lucy glanced around and then strode straight into the living room and sat in Asha's beat-up chair, which the family had brought with them from Aranuka. Molly offered Lucy something to drink, but she declined. Molly found herself strangely calm, despite having a real-life Spartan sitting in her living room. A few weeks ago, she would have fainted. "I'm here on unofficial business." "Asha and Young won't be back until tonight," Molly said. "They've been working around the clock on something." Lucy nodded. "They have an important mission." "But I said unofficial. I'm not here for them. I'm here for you. I'm here to encourage you to go back to school." Molly sat down in Young's chair and folded her arms across her chest, taking a deep breath. "Yeah, well, I don't want to." "We all have things we don't want to do, Molly, but we do them anyway. Your mission while you're here in Onyx is to get an education."
"I can do that at home."
"At the Pax Institute."
"Why?"
"You already know why, Molly. Part of Paxopolis's purpose is to show that humans and other intelligent species can actually live and work together in a real and authentic way. That's one of the main reasons for this whole thing." Molly gently rubbed her eye, which still ached.
"And what if we can't?"
"That was a human who gave you that shiner, not an elite."
"Because I was dumb enough to step between him and an alien."
"That alien's name is Bakar, and it happened because you were brave enough to step in and help."
"For all the good it did me."
"I said you were brave, not smart." Lucy came across as so serious that it took Molly a moment to realize she was joking. Spartans had an extremely dry sense of humor, apparently. At least this one did. Molly wondered if that had something to do with their training. Some rumors alleged that the Spartans had been raised from childhood to be soldiers. It had always seemed far-fetched to Molly, but not so much now that she'd met a couple of them.
"Well, how could I help that?" Molly said, growing more offended as she thought about what had been said. "There were three of them, and they were all bigger and stronger than me."
Lucy smiled at her. "You're about the same height as me, Molly."
"Yeah, but I'm no Spartan. You probably could have taken those boys down blindfolded."
"Yeah, well, they were boys. But honestly, it's not because I'm stronger than them."
"Well, that doesn't hurt. They were..."
"It's because of my training and my experience. I've taken on plenty of opponents much larger and even stronger than me. And I laid them out when I needed to."
"With a weapon? Yeah."
"Not always. Working as a Spartan often isn't about charging in with guns blazing. For most of our operations out in the field, it's much more efficient to get the job done quietly. And trust me, I've done that many times."
Molly shrugged at her. "I don't see what good that does me, unless you're going to sign me up to become a Spartan."
"That's not what I had in mind. But maybe I can help you out with some training."
"Are you kidding?"
Molly was genuinely shocked.
"You're going to teach me to fight? What about the headmaster? Wouldn't she have a problem with this?"
Lucy pursed her lips for a moment. "It was Kasha's idea, actually. And it's not teaching you how to fight. If you're up for it, I can teach you self-defense, how to protect yourself and others. This isn't something you would use against the kids at school, but a way for you to help hone some of that fierceness you've got coiled up inside. It's pretty obvious you're not cut from the researcher cloth like your parents. You've got a warrior in you." Molly's breath caught in her chest. A Spartan was offering to give her combat lessons?
She couldn't believe it. It was almost too good to be true.
She tried to compose herself before responding.
"I'd love that, actually."
Lucy smiled. "Excellent. Tom and I have actually been talking about this with Director Mendez for a little while. You'll technically be our first student." First student. This told Molly that they had bigger plans for this class of theirs, but that somehow she had been selected to go first.
That was profound.
Almost too much for her to take in.
"Our goal is to teach you discipline and defense, not to make you into a weapon. We'll hold classes at the Pax Institute, right after school."
Then Molly saw the catch. She'd been trapped into going back to school. So this class is only for kids going to the Pax Institute. That's the kicker? Lucy shrugged. I'm not trying to trick you into this, Molly. But if you're going to stay home the entire time you're with us in Onyx, are you really going to need self-defense lessons? This is for kids who are willing to come out of their shell and learn what it looks like to be a soldier, even though I'm guessing your parents won't be terribly thrilled about it. Lucy was completely right. They wouldn't be thrilled about it at all, but the opportunity had come directly from a Spartan and involved Molly's peacefully agreeing to go back to school. They'd at least see it as a worthwhile compromise, she hoped. Fine. I'll go back to school. For now. That's all I ask. Lucy got up to leave. If your parents are okay with this arrangement, we'll see you tomorrow after classes. I hope this will be worth it. Lucy gave her a wry smile. Molly, that is the last thing you have to worry about in the universe. Chapter 11. When Molly finally returned to school the next day, she went with the benefit of knowing that she wouldn't have to deal with Carl, Zeb, or Andre for the time being, since they were still on week-long suspensions. The same wasn't true of anyone else there, of course. If people had ignored Molly on her first day, now they treated her as if she had the plague. She'd never been shunned before, but at first she didn't mind it much. In fact, it made things a lot easier. Molly hadn't come back to make friends. All she could think about all day was just how much she wanted to get through her time inside this stupid sphere and blast the hell out of there as soon as possible. As far as Molly was concerned, she was living in a prison. She didn't need to associate with the other inmates. She just needed to serve her time and then get out at her first chance to do so. Moving from class to class with her head down, she tried desperately to focus on the training that awaited her at the end of the day. When math class came around, she saw Kareem and Gudam. Teacher Afrid, whom she'd never before met, greeted her at the door. Without inhibition, the young boy sprang toward Molly with a spontaneous hug that she couldn't deflect. "Thanks so much for helping out my little Gudam," the young boy said in her high-pitched voice. The teacher's grateful embrace was cold and scaly and very unpleasant, but Molly could tell that it was sincere. The young boy looked much like Gudam, though to Molly all of their kind looked similar. The teacher was about a handspan taller than Gudam, though, with a shell a bit more vibrantly blue in parts. Unsurprisingly, Afrid seemed to have the same aggressively optimistic attitude that marked Gudam. Molly had a hard time comprehending that. Afrid's child had almost been seriously harmed by another student who hated aliens. To Molly, the strange glee about the entire circumstance was the most alien thing about her. At first blush, Molly found that unappealing. She even hated it. Afrid's little Gudam had been attacked and probably wouldn't ever truly be safe in a school with kids such as Carl, Zeb, and Andre. Who knows what would have happened if Gudam hadn't been able to get to her methane in time? Who knows what might happen once those punks come back? Molly started to wonder if this attribute of Afrid's was one of the reasons the Covenant so easily put down Ungoy and used them as expendable soldiers by the thousands. But Molly also found something about the Ungoy's demeanor, a happiness that seemed unshakable, vaguely infectious. It seemed impossible to remain irritated with Afrid, even for the length of class. Apparently the Ungoy teacher refused to let her joy be controlled by others. There was something heartening in that. In the meantime, Gudam seemed perfectly fine and was just as talkative as ever. Molly hadn't given much thought to her since the event, but found herself relieved that the Ungoy hadn't been seriously injured. "Mama Beskin patched me right up as soon as I got home," she said, pointing to her jaw, which to Molly didn't show any sign of injury at all. Or perhaps she just couldn't tell. Papa Marfo was angry about it, but Mama Afrid managed to smooth the rough parts out of his shell. By the time I finished telling him everything, he insisted that we invite you over for dinner. Gudam looked up at Molly with wide, expectant eyes, suddenly quiet, which caught her completely off guard.
"Has an Ungoy family just invited me over to their home?"
"That's very kind," Molly said, trying to find a way out of the invitation. "But I'm not even sure what foods Ungoy eat."
"Oh, we eat all sorts of things," Gudam said with a wide grin. It seemed as if she'd already planned to overcome any objections Molly might pose.
The little alien had thought this through.
"Mostly we stick to Ungoy cuisine when we can, which is what you humans call seafood, of course. But we can really eat anything. Here in Onyx, most of the food is the human kind. So we eat lots of that, too."
Fortunately for Molly, the class began at that very moment. She wouldn't have to give Gudam a firm answer. Yet. Molly couldn't help but notice a few of the other human students giving her sidelong glances about it. But she ignored them. Molly might not want to dine in an Ungoy home, but that was her choice to make, not theirs. She didn't need their approval. By the time lunch came around, Molly had already decided that she'd try to find a different place to sit. She felt that being somewhere else was the best way to put everything that had happened behind her. Perhaps if she ignored everyone, people would just leave her alone, and the day's end would come quicker. When she finally got her food, Molly scanned the hall for an empty seat. Gudam and Kareem were already sitting at a table together with no one else around. She attempted to pretend that she didn't see them, and hunted for another place to sit. The last thing she wanted was to perpetuate the notion she had some kind of friendship with those two. But every time Molly made her way toward a table full of humans, their glares forced her to veer away, and she had no plans to sit at one of the tables filled with Sangheili or Ungoy. Only one other table had lots of free seats besides the one that Gudam and Kareem were at. One Sangheili student was eating there, but Molly figured she could just sit as far away from him as possible. The Sangheili looked up at her as she walked toward the table, and then she finally recognized him. Bakar. The same Sangheili whom she'd gotten in trouble with the other day. Molly was ready to about face when she realized she'd passed the point of no return. She'd committed already. If she turned away now, it'd be even more awkward. And she definitely didn't want him to think she was a weakling. Or to be forced to admit that she'd seen Kareem and Gudam's table. The last thing she wanted to do was to sit down and talk more about Ungoy dining habits while trying to eat her own lunch. Even a thought was nauseating. Sitting across from this Bakar had to be the better option. Molly picked out a chair at that table as far from Bakar as she could manage, and placed down her tray without acknowledging the Sangheili's presence. Before she was even fully in the chair, he raised his eyes, cold and unblinking, and seemed to scowl at her. She quickly dropped her eyes to her food and began to eat. Bakar didn't. He hissed at her, ending in a low growl. "What are you doing here?" he said in Molly's language. His voice, though higher pitched than Dinnock's, was formidably and heavily laced with menace. "I need a place to eat," Molly said, her face stern. "This one was open. Do the math." Molly didn't care to explain herself more than that, or to unpack the idiom. She just lowered her eyes, then dug back into her meal. Bakar stared at her. Then he hissed again. "I do not want your friendship." That stopped Molly cold. She dropped her fork and shot the Sangheili the hardest glare she'd ever given. "That works out perfectly, then. Because you don't have it. You came to my aid against those three Nishum, and now you wish to sit and share a meal with me?" He waggled his head at Molly as though something were self-evident by that action. Molly leaned over the table and spoke to Bakar in a low voice, not bothering to hide her disdain for him any longer. "Take it easy, alien. I stepped in to help Gudam, not you." Then she pushed her tray away and stood up, preparing to leave. "And now I've lost my appetite. You made me look weak, like I needed the aid of a human." Next time, I'll just let them bust in your lizard face. That would be the more favorable thing to do.
Molly let out a bitter laugh. Are you asking me for a favor? Seriously?
Bakar scrunched all four of his mandibles together tightly. His face was fierce and tense, and he looked as if he was attempting to bite back his words. Then he pushed his tray away as well. The two stared at each other in silence for a moment.
Just leave me alone, he finally said.
Then Gudam came up and set her tray down on the table, equidistant from both Bakar and Molly, the young goy's beady eyes darting back and forth between the two. Molly had been so focused on Bakar that when Gudam appeared, she almost jumped out of her seat.
Hey, Gudam nearly shouted, completely oblivious of the argument going on. You must have missed me and Kareem when you were looking for a table.
Then Gudam ungracefully clambered into a chair and kept talking as though that were the most normal thing to do. Molly looked from the Sangheili to the Yungoy, then took a deep breath and leaned back in her chair.
I know how easy that is to do, Gudam said. For one, I'm so short that you can't help but overlook me. Get it?
Kareem approached slowly from behind the Yungoy, looking entirely uncomfortable about the situation. He must have read between the lines and probably knew that Molly didn't want to be Gudam's friend, no matter how excited about that possibility the Yungoy might be. But what had to be even more uncomfortable for him was how to navigate the obvious tension between Molly and Bakar, who sat scowling at each other.
And as far as Kareem goes, Gudam said, still in her own world, well, he's a male human. I find them hard to tell apart, don't you?
Molly took a sip of water and swallowed. Her lunch was already ruined. What did she have to lose by talking to an Ungoy who wanted to accidentally poison her over dinner?
I could pick Kareem out of a crowd, she said to Gudam, grimacing at the awkward situation. But I am a human, you know. Telling them apart is more important to me. I suppose it is, the Yungoy said, somehow excited by that. How amazing that must be, to have grown up with so many strange creatures around you at all times. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine. My clutchlings and I look almost identical. Our parents can tell us apart, but it's hard for anyone outside the family to manage it, even among other Yungoy.
As her nerves started to settle, Molly took a deep breath and asked herself a simple question. What do I have to lose? Peering hard at the Yungoy, Molly asked, You are Gudam, aren't you? The Yungoy stopped for a moment, trying to process if Molly was serious, then spontaneously cackled long and hard. It was so loud that everyone in the dining hall turned for a moment to look for the origin of the sound. Gudam slowed down and readied her response.
Why would I tell you that? She gasped for air between each word. That would only ruin the surprise.
Enough! Bakar spoke so loudly that it caused Molly to flinch. He stood up from the table and stormed away, no doubt thinking they were foolish children who had spoiled his brooding. The three of them silently watched him leave, not until the Sangheili had completely exited the building for the recreation yard did Molly breathe a sigh of relief. Until that moment, she'd been slightly worried that Bakar might be angry enough to physically take his frustrations out on her.
He's a little touchy about the fight, Kareem said.
Why? Molly asked.
He didn't get into any trouble.
That's the problem, Kareem said, finally sitting down. The other Sangheili fledglings here expect him to stand up for himself and knock the insolence out of any stupid Nishum who dares taunt him. When he doesn't do that, they give him hell for it.
Nishum, why does everyone keep saying that?
It's what the Sangheili call humans, like their version of Hingehead, Kareem said, looking down toward the table. Not exactly flattering. I think it means intestinal parasite or something.
Gross, Molly said with an expression that matched. So why doesn't he knock those boys around? He seems perfectly angry enough to do it.
Kareem shrugged.
Not sure exactly.
Some of the students I've overheard talking about Bakar claim he's a bit of a pacifist, especially as far as male Sangheili are concerned. He doesn't want to fight anyone unless he absolutely has to, and the others think he's a coward for it. It's also why he gets picked on, Kadam said. He's the only Sangheili who will take it.
Couldn't the others stick up for him? Molly asked.
They could, but it's offensive and shameful to do so, Kareem said. In their culture, you do these sorts of things for yourself, or you suffer the consequences. Survival of the fittest in every sense. Things have gotten even worse for Bakar since the incident the other day. Apparently others are pressuring him hard to take down one of the humans who started all of this.
Good, Molly said enthusiastically. He ought to get back at those jerks. He should go after them off school property and beat the daylights out of them. That might be what it takes to finally shut them up for good.
She pulled her tray close now that Bakar was gone. The food was cold, but eating it was better than nothing.
What's stopping him?
Maybe he's already seen enough violence in his day, Gudam responded solemnly. I hear he lost his mother in the war, and he never talks about the rest of his family. That's pretty unusual for a Sangheili, though. The pursuit of peace, that is. They tend to think with their weapons. They brutalized my people during the war, I'm told, although I didn't see any of that personally, of course. In the Covenant, my fellow Ungoy were little better than slaves to be ordered around, and kicked when we weren't doing our jobs fast enough.
Molly knew the background of the Ungoy to some degree, but she hadn't thought about how it might affect them on a personal level at all. The Ungoy had certainly been unwilling participants in the war, a species that didn't have much of a choice but to go along while the Sangheili mercilessly abused them. In the Covenant, they'd been victims too. And looking at Gudam, Molly couldn't help but feel compassion for the small creature. It did not, however, change her mind about going to dinner at Gudam's house.
But Bakar isn't like that? Molly asked.
Gudam shook her head. He hates the war. Hates even talking about it. He's very unlike his fellows in that way. I have only one class with Sangheili, and he is in it. Lots of them like to go on about how they long for a battle in which they can finally prove themselves. They just don't have anyone to fight these days, especially in here. They're kind of a peculiar breed of creature, always so hungry for violence.
Molly couldn't help but marvel a bit at Gudam's description. The Ungoy was far more contemplative and well-balanced than Molly had given her credit for.
What happened to the rest of your kind after the war?
There are many Ungoy out there. Kadam nibbled something on her plate that looked like rubber. Molly looked away when her stomach started to turn. Some went home to Balaho. Others are employed on different worlds. Some even remain slaves. I'm sure there are a few insane ones who have taken up arms with hostile factions like the Servants of the Abiding Truth, or what's left of the Covenant. They would rather keep the old ways than follow the Arbiter and his Swords of Sangheilios toward some kind of peace. Molly had her back to the rest of the room while Gudam was talking, so she didn't see the drink pouch come sailing over her shoulder until it landed square in the middle of the table. It splattered directly on top of Bakar's abandoned tray and sent the plates there scattering, splashing cold liquid and leftover scraps of food everywhere. Molly wound up with her entire face and chest coated with the bluish drink and a pale white paste Bakar had been eating, something the color and consistency of bird excrement. The stench was unbearable. She leaped to her feet in a cold rage, spinning around and shouting at the rest of the dining hall. Who did that? No one took credit. A bunch of the students farther away from Molly's table burst out laughing instead, which only infuriated her more. She didn't have anyone to focus her wrath on, though, which made things even worse. There were just too many of them, and in the moment she felt as though they were all against her. After glaring for a few seconds, completely covered in food and drink, Molly spun on her heel and made for the exit, determined to find a restroom and clean herself up as best as she could. "You eat with a filthy animal and you're going to get dirty," someone shouted from the other side of the dining hall. The laughter was even louder this time. and Molly's anger burned even hotter. Chapter 12. After the Pale Blade and his Splinter Strike team of servants exterminated all the humans at the portal site, Dural Mdama found that his only regret was that there had not been more of them. His heart surged as they cut their foes down. When the brief battle was spent, he joined his warriors in their cries of triumph. These were the first humans Dural had ever bested, but they would certainly not be the last. Burren attempted to dampen their joy by pointing out the obvious fact that the humans would be missed by those who had sent them. Dural knew that was a reasonable concern, but he quickly put an end to Burren's complaint by having the servants toss the bodies out into the darkness, where the monsters that had frightened the humans in the first place could have them. If the gods were with the servants, any humans who came looking for their allies would likely think that the creatures had killed them. After all, Dural considered, how could the servants of the Abiding Truth have possibly gained entry into Onyx? But he certainly was not foolish enough to stay there and spoil the secret of their incursion. It was one thing to take on a handful of humans with an advanced strike force, but a major reprisal by their enemies could have wiped out his team completely and wasted any advantage they now held. The small group of servants swiftly returned to the first site they had entered on Onyx, and Dural made Evenkeel seal off the portal to the place where the monsters roamed. They would have to try another location, and yet another if need be, until the right fortification availed itself to them. The next place they found via the portal system stood entirely abandoned, and this one had plenty of space for all of their forces. According to Evenkeel, it was approximately 100 kilometers from the primary human settlement, and in a completely unoccupied territory, which put plenty of room between them and their foes. The chances were incredibly small that the humans would locate the servants there, much less accidentally stumble upon them. Yet it allowed them an opportunity to spy on the humans from a safe distance. The location turned out to be even better than Dural had imagined. It was large and well protected, with a receiving portal capable of letting them finally send through much of what they had originally brought to Hesduros. Panom would no doubt be furious when the servants that Dural had left behind began reneging on his original promise, transporting much of their arsenal into Onyx. But that was due to Panom's own foolishness. Once the Splinter team had set up camp there, the Pale Blade called the rest of his warriors from Hesduros, and they ferried as much of their weaponry and equipment as they could manage to their new fortification. Panom would have to make do with whatever remained, which, to Dural, was still far more than the weak Kaidan deserved. Many of the heavy vehicles had to remain behind regardless, and would guard the portal on Hesduros until he found a way to bring them through to Onyx. The new site was a large forerunner structure composed almost entirely of a seamless ivory substance, with angular and geometric adornments. Inside the structure's primary space was a long chamber, with a narrow perpendicular nave-like segment at its center. As the structure rose upward, it had dozens of floors with different configurations. The lowest lay entirely underground, while ramps and interwoven passages rose to each of the higher levels. The level where they had emerged through the portal stood 20 meters above Onyx's surface, with several pathways to parapets and turrets. The most impressive aspect of this place was the ceiling, which climbed another 100 more levels above the highest floor, almost entirely out of sight. Vast, semi-transparent apertures allowed light to flood this structure, all the way to the very bottom, but despite its general openness, it somehow also felt entirely secure. Clearly, the home of a god, Dural thought to himself. He named the place the Loa Tamak Kroiha Avamid Tilkam, which in his tongue meant the Great Cathedral of the esteemed Avu Med Telkam. Dural hoped it paid appropriate homage to the late Fieldmaster, although most of his warriors would simply refer to it in shorthand going forward as the cathedral. It certainly reminded him of the cathedral strongholds of old Sanghelios. The massive structure was formed around three spires, each of which launched up into the arched ceilings, with buttresses so high that they could almost not be seen from the ground. Its very nature inspired awe and reverence for its creators, making it the perfect fortress for the servants of the abiding truth. It took Dural's warriors days to get everything into the structure, and even more to effectively install their weapons and vehicles to the Pale Blade's liking. By the time they were finished, what had been a desolate chamber was now transformed into an impenetrable and fully weaponized citadel. The site was entirely covered by several dozen gunner nests, including a variety of plasma turrets and directed energy emplacements, as well as explosive mortars, flak cannons, and targeting sensors they had placed with strategic care in the surrounding dense forest. To Dural, it seemed as if the cathedral could withstand anything the humans could throw at it, just shy of an attack from one of their nuclear devices. He was pleased, but he could tell that discontentment was growing among the Sangheili.
"Your warriors are getting restless," Rook said,
as he, Dural, and Burren surveyed their accomplishments from a vantage point high in the cathedral. "They have tasted battle once on this world, and now they ache for more."
"As do I," Dural assured Rook. "We did not come here to set up a keep only to become farmers. I already have plans in motion that will bring us the kind of victory that has eluded Jewel Ndama and his covenant for so many years."
"And just how do you propose to do that?" Burren said, thinly veiling his contempt for the young leader. "Will you attack another group of weaklings to prove our superiority?" The old shipmaster had become surlier with each day they spent inside Onyx. It was as if the very air in the place irritated him. Dural wasn't entirely sure what to make of this growing insolence, only that it tired him. When Avu Med Telkam had been alive, Burren had held back such impudence. But now things had changed. Burren had never been fond of Dural's relationship with the Fieldmaster, nor was he pleased with the Pale Blade's rise to power. It only made sense that Burren was uncomfortable taking orders from a warrior decades younger, and he finally had reached the point at which he meant to vocalize it. Dural knew that the day was quickly approaching when his patience with the fossil would run dry and he would be forced to put the Sangheili down. "We are superior," Dural said. "We have nothing to prove." "Or perhaps you simply want to alert the entirety of the human military that we are here, so they can rain down death upon us while we cower in this cathedral of yours." "Perhaps today is that day," Dural thought. His hand snaked out at a speed Burren could not foresee and struck him in the throat. The grizzled Sangheili collapsed next to him, grasping his neck and struggling for air. The Pale Blade loomed over him, hissing, "You are fortunate that we three are alone here, Burren Uttaral. If you had tried to shame me in front of my warriors, I would have been forced to tear your head from your shoulders." Burren nodded a weak apology through his coughing and choking.
"We have weapons and warriors," Rook said to Burren,
"but we lack heavier vehicles and ships. With some effort, we managed to move a number of ghosts and banshees through the portal, as well as our shades, but nothing larger than those. We must be strategic and careful in our planning, as the Pale Blade no doubt has been. If we attack the human settlement head-on with our current forces, they are sure to slaughter us."
"You speak the truth, Rook," Dural said, leering down at Burren, who still grasped at his neck. "But there is something we require even more. Fortunately, we have the favor of the gods on our side. What we need will certainly come to us if we strive for it." And how shall we do this? Rook said, evidently confused by Dural's vague language. The younger warrior was not ready to